considered there.
May it please the court. My name is Gary Sibley, and along with Mr. Gregory, I'm here on behalf of the petitioner. This is a contract case between Harold Criswell, an engineer, and European Crossroads Shopping Center and R.M. Ginsberg, one of its general partners. The shopping center several years ago was not doing well. The parties who owned the shopping center wished the best themselves of it. A problem, however, existed, and that was that sufficient information did not exist upon which to base a sale. Not to belabor the point, but one of the problems was that walls had been moved on various floors as tenants moved in and out. So the square footage, as reflected in tenant leases, did not add up properly to the total amount in the center. In fact, it was over 10,000 square feet off. The other problem was that European Crossroads either did not have enough money to pay someone to recompute those figures and to compile the data, or did not want to spend it at that time. So they approached Harold Criswell, who was the engineer who originally built the project, and asked him if he would prepare data to give to real estate agents to sell the project. In exchange for him doing that, they would pay him 1% of the sales price of the project when the project sold either as a whole or as a condominium unit. What this allowed was them to be able to afford to hire someone to collect the data necessary so that they'd be able to sell their project. The purpose of the contract was to sell the shopping center, not to convert it to condominium units. The contract read as follows. This is to confirm our conversation over the telephone regarding the above property. I will compile and prepare all information necessary for real estate agents to show and sell the above property on a condominium basis, semicolon, i.e., to be able to sell each individual building, building 1 through 9, as a separate item with necessary information to form an association to accommodate maintenance, taxes, necessary exterior utilities, and any other community expenses, semicolon, or as a whole project. I will also prepare and have available any and all necessary information that a proposed owner or owners would deem pertinent or desirable, and prepare the information that he may desire at his request. For the above services, the European Crossroads will compensate to me at my office, and gives the address, a fee of 1% of the total sales price of each building, buildings, or the entire project at the time of closing. The issue in the case is whether or not the contract that I've just read contained a condition precedent. The courts below
agree it's not ambiguous.
Both parties agree that the contract is not ambiguous. That's correct.
Always a little curious that parties in a contract case agree that it's not ambiguous, but neither they can't agree on what the unambiguous meaning is.
That's correct. In fact, I would assume that's generally the circumstance. Both courts below held that a condition precedent existed. The trial court directed a verdict on that basis, and the Court of Appeals upheld that directed verdict on the same basis. The courts, in determining what meaning is to be ascribed to the words of a contract, must look at the four corners of that instrument if it's unambiguous. In doing so, the plain meaning of those words, the plain meaning is to be ascribed to the words that were used. Also, we must look at the intent of the parties in determining what those words mean, because it can't be looked at in a vacuum. The purpose of this contract was to allow the sale of European Crossroads, not its conversion to condominium regime. It also allowed Criswell to be paid for his work.
Well, if that was the purpose, why does the contract say to show and sell property on a condominium basis?
All right. That's the purpose for which the information was sought from Criswell. Criswell was not in the position of a real estate agent. He wasn't going to show and sell the property. He was going to collect the data necessary for someone else to show and sell the property.
But you said earlier the purpose was just to sell it, not to sell it as a condominium. But doesn't the contract expressly acknowledge that the purpose was to sell it as a condominium?
That's one of the ways the contract contemplated its sale. It also contemplated its sale as a whole project. So that's the reason I say the purpose of the contract wasn't to convert it to condominium units. The purpose of the contract was to sell it, either as a condominium unit or as an entire project.
You could sell the whole, all of the buildings, all nine buildings, as a condominium project.
The problem with that is that the definition of a condominium is a piece of real estate that is owned in, at least in part, in common with other owners. And if you did that, you'd be having a common ownership with yourself.
Well, but you could just sell all nine buildings as part of a condominium project, even though eventually when the tenants moved in, they would only have ownership in one building.
That's right, but if you did that, what you'd be doing is you'd be selling the entire project, and then what they did with it, they being the purchasers, would be their own business. It would be set up for them to use as a condominium regime if they chose, but you would be selling the entire project.
Do you contend now that there's a fact issue there, or that as a matter of law you win as you did in the trial court?
Well, unfortunately, I didn't win in the trial court.
I know that.
But
you contended in the trial court that you should win as a matter of law with a motion for summary judgment. So did the other side.
Yes, sir.
The other side got granted. Are you now contending there's a fact issue?
Well, unfortunately, there is a fact issue to be decided when it's remanded. There are several fact issues to be decided when it's remanded. The Court of Appeals, however, focused their attention on condition precedent, and I think if you read that opinion, you'll see, as they address each one of the points that was brought up in the appeal, that the basis on which they upheld the trial court was their finding that there was a condition precedent.
If parties to a contract argue that it's unambiguous, but they argue different interpretations, and both of them are reasonable, can the trial judge decide if there's a fact issue and send it to the jury anyway?
If I may rephrase that, what you're asking me is, even if both of the parties say that the contract is unambiguous, if the trial court determines that an ambiguity exists, should they send it to the, I'll find out in 2 weeks when I have another argument on that point before the Court of Appeals in Dallas. My position is...
They find out in this case.
Yeah, I'm afraid I will. That if there is an ambiguity, then the judge, in his opinion, then the judge should refer to the jury.
Then can the appellate court make that same determination and remand it for a jury trial?
Not if that wasn't a point on appeal. Now, as the contract is written, allowed for all the parties to be satisfied. It allowed for European Crossroads to have the information necessary to sell the project. It allowed Criswell the reasonable expectation that he would be paid in the future at the sale of the building, either as a condominium regime or as an entire project. In order to arrive at the conclusion that the courts below did, it's going to be necessary for the court to take the contract, remove the semicolons from the second paragraph, and scratch the last "or," so that the pertinent provisions read, "I will compile and prepare all information necessary for real estate agents to show and sell the above property on a condominium basis as a whole project." And if you reconstrue that, you have a problem with the last sentence of the contract, which reads in pertinent part, "A fee of 1% of the total sales price of each building, buildings, or entire project at the time of closing." In order to be able to ascribe to this contract the plain words contained therein, you must give meaning to selling it on a condominium basis, semicolon, or as an entire project, and that he will be paid 1% of the sales price for each building, buildings, or the entire project. Petitioner is merely praying the court to read the contract using accepted rules, preserve the written integrity of the words used therein, and reverse and remand it for trial. Thank you.
Now, the respondent contends that no sale or closing occurred because it's a contract for deed. What's your answer to that?
Well, there is a case that says a contract for deed is a sale, even though the Court of Appeals didn't reach it, and I believe that case is Butcher versus Employers Casualty Company, 409 Southwest 2nd, 583, a no-writ case from Fort Worth in 1960.
Is that cited in your brief?
I don't remember whether it is or not, Your Honor. It was not a point on appeal since the court in its opinion held that they didn't reach the question of whether or not there was a sale because they reached the conclusion that a condition precedent existed, that is, the sale on a condominium basis. And the parties agreed that the sale did not take place on a condominium basis. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you, Court. The court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Ben Craig will present argument to the
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. My name is Ben Craig and I represent the respondents in this case, the European Crossroads Shopping Center at Texas Limited Partnership and one of its three general partners, R.M. Ginsburg. A directed verdict was granted after 5 days of trial by the trial court and the plaintiff appealed that directed verdict. The defendants brought forth cross points in the Court of Appeals that were not reached and have preserved them here just in case this court decides to reverse the decision of the trial court and remand the case. I just want to remind the court I do have cross points that were not reached in the Court of Appeals and they have been preserved here. The issue before the court is this: whether the trial court's interpretation of the letter agreement written by Mr. Criswell, the engineer, was reasonable. That's the issue. That's the only issue that's really here to be decided by this court.
Why do we have to defer to the trial court's determination of the law just because it may be reasonable?
I don't think you have to defer to the trial court's determination of law. I think you have to defer to the trial court's determination of the factual matter of whether or not the interpretation is reasonable.
Well, is this a factual, is the interpretation of this contract a fact issue or a legal issue?
Well, it's a legal issue, purely a legal issue. Neither of the parties pleaded ambiguity, and absent such a pleading, it would not be permissible for the trial court to try that issue to a jury.
Right. So if it's a legal issue, why do we have to defer to the trial court's decision on the law?
If you believe that the decision of the trial court was reasonable, you must affirm. That's the standard of review by the Court of Appeals and by this court. You're not bound by the Court of Appeals decision, but if you believe that the trial court's interpretation was a reasonable one, you're bound to affirm, even if you think that there are other reasonable interpretations.
What's your authority for that?
Brown versus Brown, the Amarillo 1951 writ refused case. If the trial court's decision was a reasonable one with respect to what he interpreted the intent of the parties to be in light of all the circumstances, an appellate court may not, if it agrees that he was reasonable, may not reverse.
That was a summary judgment case?
No, Your Honor, that
was
not a summary judgment case.
Probably a trial, non-jury.
Excuse me, sir?
Probably it was a non-jury trial.
It may very well have been. I cannot recall at the moment
the
circumstances. If the issue, the fact issue was submitted to the trial court as a fact question and rules of construction were applied to an ambiguous agreement, I would agree. But that's not the case here, and we're dealing with interpretation, not construction. The rules of construction have no applicability to this case.
Brown, you don't quote anything from the Brown case. I assume Brown doesn't say that in so many words. There must be some.
Brown says if the trial court's interpretation of a contract is a reasonable interpretation in the mind of the reviewing court, then that determination, that interpretation, should not be reversed.
But interpretation implies ambiguity, doesn't it?
No, sir, it does not. In fact, it is a process that every lawyer and judge that looks at a contract undertakes. Professor Ray, in his article on parole evidence, goes to some length to explain the difference between contract interpretation and applying the parole evidence to an ambiguous contract, and notes a very distinct difference, that you must interpret a contract in the light of its surrounding circumstances, so that evidence that aids the court or the decider in determining what the contract intent was of the parties is always admissible, because that evidence and that process recognizes the supremacy of the contract. It does not try to annex itself to it nor change it.
You're talking about the fact-finding process there.
No, I'm talking
about summary judgment.
I'm talking about the legal determination by a trial court or a court of appeals or this court.
Well, you just got to mention jury and ambiguity and
that's where the parole evidence rule comes in. If you have an ambiguity and the trial court says it's ambiguous, then you've got a fact issue and parole evidence is admissible to define to the finder of fact the intent of the parties. That's not this case.
Let me see if I understand you. You're saying that if we think that there's a fact issue, that that doesn't make any difference. It's what the trial court said that controls.
Frankly, it's what the parties originally say in their pleadings that controls that issue. If the parties do not allege ambiguity and apply to the trial court for a finding that the contract's ambiguous, the trial court may not submit that issue to the trial court.
There's no authority for that. You can do, a trial court can deny both motions for summary judgment and submit it to the jury. And no one would argue with that.
Yes, he can. And I do not, that would not be appealable or anything else. He can always do that if he wants. My point is that absent a pleading of ambiguity by a party, the court should not. He should simply interpret the contract as it's written in light of its surrounding circumstances. He may very well convince one or more of the parties that he thinks it's ambiguous and they ought to plead for it, and they probably would. But absent such a pleading, the trial court simply must apply the factual circumstances under which the contract arose and reach a decision. He might be wrong, and a court of appeals might believe that his interpretation was unreasonable. And in that case, then that court may apply its own matter of law determination of what's reasonable in the context of where that contract arose.
You're saying that the question before us is not whether or not there was a fact issue, but whether or not the trial court was unreasonable in what it did?
Yes. That is the issue. Whether or not...
You think we have the power as a law court to take the contract and apply the rules of interpretation?
You may, yes.
Without regard to what the... bottom line, the trial court came down with.
No, the process for you to do that is to determine in your own mind whether or not the trial court's determination was an unreasonable one. You're to apply the rules of interpretation just like that court. You might conclude that there are other reasonable interpretations, although in this case I don't think that's possible, because you have to look at the circumstances and the context in which this case arose. But that's the job of this court, to review the trial court's finding for unreasonable.
But the strongest meaning of what a contract says is what the plain words say. I mean,
there's no question about that.
We apply the rules of interpretation as to looking to certain customs within the trade or pass it in the party if, looking at the words of the contract, we are befuddled.
But the court cannot do that in a vacuum, and neither can a trial court or the court of appeals. And this analysis should not be done in a vacuum. The undisputed facts that I think form the context in which the interpretation job has to be done are as follows. This shopping center was built in 1972. It was an existing shopping center. It was a unique type of shopping center. 9 separate buildings devoted to France and Germany, and that's where the name European Crossroads came from. It was financed with a first mortgage held by Cleve Trust. Mr. Criswell was one of the original engineers that participated in the structure of the building with the architect. He officed at the project and continued to provide engineering services for tenant finish out over the years. He provided drawings for this and kept those drawings. The center was a financial bust. It was an economic disaster. And over the years, the general partners were always trying to find money and ways to finance and get capital infusions. In 1980, one of the general partners dreamed up the idea of converting this project to a condominium, an office commercial condominium complex. These are undisputed facts. The statement that there was insufficient information to sell the property is not of record. The statement that there was insufficient money to pay someone to do engineering services is not of record. These economic problems led to this idea to convert this to a condominium. You don't need an engineer to go out and sell a single unit piece of real property in this state. You do for purposes of providing information necessary to create a condominium regime. Now, the general partner knew that Cleve Trust was aware that this would be a difficult job, and they would have to convince the underlying mortgagee to permit such a conversion. That's why the discussions were had with Mr. Criswell. I will not go into those discussions prior to writing the contract. They are the subject of one of my cross points. The letter agreement was drafted by Mr. Criswell. It's found on page 8, reproduced on page 8 of Appley's of respondent's brief. It was written by Mr. Criswell. It defines the scope of his job. He did certain work in accordance with that, and the work was he simply took the drawings that he already had, changed the date on them. He got information from the owner, retyped it, and then created two exemplar surveys for two of the 9 buildings. He did not provide any of the engineering services for any of the other condo conversion. It was clear that this was an example document to be given to Cleve Trust. It was given to Cleve Trust by Ginsburg, the general partner. They refused to permit the condominium conversion. Now, a year later, a capital infusion is developed for this property. It has nothing to do with the condominium. It was done on the terms of a contract for deed for tax purposes. It did not involve Mr. Criswell or any work that he did. He claims he's entitled to 1% of the sales price. Now, the reasons why the interpretation of the trial court was correct and valid is two. Number one, in the context of all of that, you don't need an engineer to do anything to sell this property as an individual unit of real property. You do if you want to put it to a condominium regime. Secondly, this was not a project in 1980. It was an existing shopping center. Mr. Criswell used the term the entire project twice in his written contract, meaning what project was ongoing at that time? The conversion to a condominium. That was the project that we're talking about. If you examine the context in which this case arises, and if you look at the words that Mr. Criswell, the engineer, used, and while they are not a model of clarity, I believe you will be convinced that the trial court and the Court of Appeals' interpretation of the contract was accurate, that it did deal with a sale of this property on a condominium conversion, and it did require that. That's what Criswell was there for. That's the only reason to have an engineer. There was never a sale on a condominium basis. The sale that he says he's entitled to 1% of occurred over a year later, had nothing to do with him and his work, and was a contract done on a contract for deed as a method for obtaining additional capital.
Did Mr. Criswell deliver his work product to European Crossroads?
Yes, sir, he did.
And they were in possession of them at the time they made this contract for sale?
I don't know. That was not clear, but the evidence was undisputed that document had nothing to do with that transaction and was not involved in that transaction. That is undisputed.
I haven't read the contract, but did the contract have any date limitations in it?
Excuse me?
Did the contract that Mr. Criswell prepared have any time limitation in it?
No, Your Honor, it did not. Although Mr. Criswell would seem to think that it would apply into perpetuity, one of the other issues that we've raised is,
as a matter of fact, how much time did elapse
between the time that he delivered the work and the time of the ultimate sale was over a year, about 13 months. Mr. Ginsburg took the document to Cleve Trust. Cleve Trust refused to give its permission to convert these properties to a condominium. Mr. Ginsburg told Criswell that, and that was the end of it. Criswell did no further work on this project whatsoever. And in fact, there was never a full-blown, true engineering survey ever done. Even Mr. Criswell admitted that what he did was simply to make up off of a map some meets and bounds descriptions.
Was Mr. Criswell's work product delivered to the ultimate purchaser?
No, Your Honor, it was not. But let me say this. There is no evidence in the record that happened, and the evidence was contrary from the defendant that it was not involved in that sale. But that work product had nothing to do with that sale. It was not involved. It was not delivered. That's the status of the record. Mr. Criswell had no way of knowing one way or another, so the only evidence came from the defendants in that case. And I do not believe that the ultimate purchaser was deposed or provided evidence.
Could the trial court grant a summary judgment in this case?
Yes, the trial court could have granted summary judgment. In my opinion, I think it was safer for the trial court to receive evidence so that it could conduct a fuller interpretation in the context of more evidence. And I think the trial court wanted to do that, and that's the reason the trial court denied the summary judgment and then granted the direct verdict. Although I think sufficient summary judgment evidence could have been presented on those undisputed facts that I've talked about that remained undisputed trial that would have allowed summary judgment.
Let me just string out a little hypothetical here about what a trial judge is supposed to do in a situation where neither party has pled ambiguity, but at least one party is claiming that the contract needs to be interpreted in the light of the circumstances. If a jury fee has been paid by a party, and the trial judge denies the summary judgment, sets the case for trial, impanels the jury after a voir dire, sits there, listens to testimony from both sides, knowing full well that with no pleading for ambiguity, he should not submit any jury issues. And then at the close of the evidence, you thank the jury, give them their $5, and he renders a judgment. Is that the scheme in Texas?
That is a permissible and available scheme in Texas where the evidence that is presented during that period of time of trial...
Well, what else should a trial judge do? He shouldn't grant summary judgment if he thinks the contract needs interpretation. I mean, he ought to listen to testimony and cross-examination.
But it's
still a legal question.
I disagree. Interpretation is a legal question. This particular judge decided not to grant the summary judgment. He wanted to hear evidence.
And
if the evidence upon which he relies is undisputed or conclusively established, absolutely
not. When he listens to that evidence, once it's controverted, he should just flush that out of his mind.
I think he may not rely upon controverted or disputed ultimate issues of fact as imposing on his decision to do an interpretation of the contract. I think if he has a question about that, he can submit that issue to the jury.
Well, there might be circumstances surrounding the drafting or the contract itself, which he might want to hear testimony about that. And some of that might be controversial, might it?
That is possible, and he would not be permitted to either grant a summary judgment or to base his interpretation on anything that was controversial, anything that would qualify as parole evidence that would be in dispute.
So one last question. For instance, if it was in question who had drafted the contract, each party claimed the other side had drafted it, you could impanel the jury, take testimony on that issue, and let the jury decide that question. And then having that fact in hand, you would go and interpret the contract.
No, that would not be permissible because the question of who drafted the contract is irrelevant unless ambiguity is pleaded and found by a trial court.
That's not one of the rules of interpretation.
That is not a rule of interpretation. It is a rule of construction of an ambiguous contract.
Let me ask one more question. There was no provision in the contract for the payment of Mr. Criswell if the property did not sell. Then his work was to be paid for when the property was sold. Isn't that correct?
When the property
there was no other payment. The only provision for payment for that work was out of the sale, he would get 1%.
It was a contingency fee, if you will.
And the contract said that if all or any part of it sold, then he gets 1%.
If it's on a condominium basis, yes, Your Honor.
No, as I understand, the work was that he was to give the engineering, to do all the engineering work for condominium, but if it sold in part or all of it, then at that point he would get 1%. Is that correct?
If the sales that generated from that work were condominium sales, either as a whole condominium project to a syndicator or individual condominium units, under those circumstances, yes, Your Honor.
But isn't it true, though, that if I bought a condominium project, then after that title came to me, then I could do whatever I wanted to with it, tear it down, convert it back to separate units or whatever.
If that was your decision after it had been sold to you in a...
But if I bought it all, and so that's what this contract provided. If all of it was sold, then he was to get 1%.
If it was sold as part of a prepackaged condominium regime, because Ginsburg testified as part of the evidence that his goal was to sell it off in condos or to attract a syndicator after it had been converted to a condominium regime, and sell it to a syndicator, possibly, and let him sell off chunks.
Sell it to anybody.
Or anybody, but the testimony was to a syndicator. That was his goal.
Now, is it your contention that there was not a sale as described in that contract because there was a contract for deed?
In this case, and in the context of this case, yes. But as between the purchaser and seller, in a normal situation, there is no difference between a mortgage and a deed and a contract for deed.
What is this different then?
Because in this particular situation, what happened here was a method of simply raising additional capital. And the testimony was that it was structured in a contract for deed fashion for tax purposes and to attract that capital. The seller retained the back-end interest at all times.
Until he was fully paid.
Even on a refinancing or resale by that purchaser, they retained a back-end interest under the transaction. So it was a very complicated tax structure transaction. It was different.
But it was not a sale.
In the context of this contract with Mr. Criswell, it was not a sale.
Well, the people that entered into the new contract, did they think they were buying something?
I have no idea what they thought, Your Honor.
They were putting up a lot of money, though.
At this point in time, this was a transaction substantially induced by then existing tax benefits, and it was a method of putting capital into a failing shopping center project. And that was the process, and that was the evidence.
I have one last question. I don't think we've raised it, but it's been of concern to me where the contract says, on a condominium basis, semicolon, i.e., so-and-so, and so-and-so, and so forth, semicolon, or on a whole, or as a whole project. Do you think that the risk of being called a semicolon, court? Do you think that there's any significance to the fact that that's a semicolon instead of a comma?
Absolutely.
Does it not separate out the two elements?
Absolutely not. I don't think any more is provided by the use of a semicolon than a comma. I don't think you need anything in there to interpret this contract. I dare say we don't want to interpret it on the basis of a semicolon as opposed to a comma.
What about the word or, where it says a condominium basis or as a whole project?
I believe in the context in which the contract arose, and the use of the term project implies condominium sale because of how the contract arose and what the idea was. This was not a shopping center under construction. It was not a project. It had been in existence for 8 years at this time. The only project that existed was the condominium conversion project at that time.
Any other questions?
Yes. Let me just be sure.
Maybe we should have given 20 minutes.
It sounds like we were underestimated this one. If the parties do not plead that a contract is ambiguous, they take conflicting positions, the trial court adopts one of those positions as a matter of law. There's an appeal, and the appeals court decides 2-1 for the opposing position, and for some reason we should decide to take that case, and it comes before us, and now we have judges disagreeing in the lower courts about what is reasonable and what isn't, and the parties both insisting that it's not ambiguous. Must we just decide which one of those we think is the best interpretation as a matter of law, or should the court send the case back for factual determination?
You should decide whether or not the trial court's decision was reasonable or not. That's the decision, and if you decide that it was, then you affirm that decision. If you decide that it was not, then you reverse and either render judgment as the contract should have been interpreted or send it back if needed for further proceedings to accomplish whatever else was left undone.
And that's based on Brown.
Yes, Your Honor, and I believe based upon the requirements of the necessity to plead ambiguity in Texas in order to generate the rules of construction and the admission of parole evidence.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, Mr. Gregory will now present the rebuttal argument for the petition.
May it please court, my name is Joe Gregory. I was the attorney that tried this particular case in the trial court below. I would like to first point out and request that this court secure a copy of Brown v. Brown and read that particular opinion. Now, what Brown v. Brown in fact did, not a complex case, Brand versus Brand dealt with factually involved the filing of a instrument in writing that was then allowed under Texas law in order to adopt children. The particular instrument that was filing had a concluding phrase within it that stated, quote,
the adopted children would be treated like regular children.
In essence, Your Honor, in point of fact, the particular language was, the said children shall share our property as provided by the laws of Texas.
Now, then that one parent died and the other parent died and he's got $5.
Right. In point of fact, what it occurred, Your Honors, is there were some natural children that were also belonged to these adopted parents. And in the will, the adopted parents gave their property to the natural children and gave to the two adoptive children who were adopted according to that instrument that was filed in the deed records, $5 each. The contention on appeal by the adopted children was that that language agreement means that we're entitled to inherit under the laws of descent and distribution, meaning we're entitled to a child's share as if they died intestate. There is not one word in that opinion that indicates that if the trial court's interpretation of an agreement is reasonable, then the appellate court is bound by it. Not one word in it. Now, I would like to also correct, there was indication that, quote, by the respondent that there is no evidence in this case that there was insufficient information that existed at that time to sell the project. One of the plaintiff's experts in this case was Mr. Billy Truax, former Dallas Cowboy that is involved primarily in real estate as a broker, who testified that he had syndicated himself a number of different projects, had been involved in condominiums himself, and at that time he was tendered the booklet that Mr. Creswell put together over a period of approximately 4 months. It was shown to him. The defendants had several exhibits constituting a miscellaneous assortment of lease records, reflecting in certain cases that there was X number of square feet available for lease, and in other cases, due to the fact that it went through many different managers, something in the neighborhood of 10,000 feet less for lease in this total space. Mr. Truax testified that he could not, as a real estate agent, based on the information that they had prior to preparation of Mr. Creswell's booklet, sell this property because nobody knew what was there. That was the need.
Can't anybody with a tape measure go out there and count up the square feet? Why do you need a civil engineer?
Your Honor, the particular problem, why do you need a civil engineer? Because we had 9 separate bids. We had 27 separate floors. And no telling how many different walls within this unit. Now, customarily, we all know that lease space, when it's rented itself, it rents on a square footage basis primarily. And if a reasonably intelligent buyer is going to purchase a piece of property, he is going to want to know what he's purchasing. Sure, we could take a tape measure. But in this particular case, Creswell, he was a natural person for European Crossroads to approach, because he had, with his work product, his structural engineering drawings that located each particular spot throughout this entire property. Your Honors,
any other questions? All right, another question. Where's your son?
Your Honor, we would respectfully request, we do agree that this contract is unambiguous. If you apply the normal rules of construction, don't disregard the semicolons. Don't completely strike the or. Give the contract its ordinary meaning, keeping in mind the overall purpose was to bail out European Crossroads from the Senate. European Crossroads, Your Honor, who was distinctly different, separate from the buyer under the contract for deed. We would respectfully request that this honorable court reverse this case and remand it to the trial court so a jury can be impaneled to determine the factual issues involved. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument, and the second calls will take another brief recess.
The audience is good, Roger.